WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest is composer John Adams. He was once described by conductor Edo De Vart as being in the forefront of a group that believed music didn't have to be ugly to be contemporary. Adams intentionally blurs distinctions between, quote, serious music and pop. His orchestral music has used synthesizers, drum machines, and saxophone quartet, and has alluded to all the music that he's been affected by, including jazz, ragtime, rock, and minimalism. Adams is now best known for his opera Nixon in China, about Richard Nixon's historic visit to the People's Republic in 1972. Adams has lived in San Francisco for about 20 years, where he's taught at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music and led their New Music Ensemble, and has worked with the San Francisco Symphony as new music consultant and composer in residence. Adams' new record features his new composition, The Wound Dresser, which uses the text of the Walt Whitman poem. The Wound Dresser describes Whitman's experiences nursing wounded soldiers during the Civil War. Adams found the poem to be particularly relevant today, with so many people filling hospital wards suffering from AIDS, and with so many homeless people struggling out on the streets. The poem also had personal relevance for Adams.
I was writing this piece during the final stages of my father's decline into death due to Alzheimer's disease. And I think that particular event and the relationship that went on between my mother, who was caring for him, and him, brought home this act of nursing, this act of compassion, which Whitman spoke so eloquently about in the first person.
Before we hear your composition, The Wound Dresser, I'd like for you to read the first stanza of the poem, which is the stanza that we'll be hearing in the excerpt we're going to play.
Bearing the bandages, water, and sponge, straight and swift to my wounded I go, where they lie on the ground after the battle brought in, where their priceless blood reddens the grass, the ground, or to the rows of the hospital tent, or under the roofed hospital, to the long rows of cots, up and down each side, I return. To each and all, one after the other, I draw near. Not one do I miss. An attendant follows, holding a tray. He carries a refuse pail, soon to be filled with clotted rags and blood, emptied and filled again.
Could you just talk a bit about the musical mood that you wanted to convey in the music?
Well, like all of Whitman's poetry, it's in the first person. It's always, I did this, I felt this, I went here, I encountered this person. I actually lopped off the first couple of stanzas of the poem because I felt that they did typify Whitman at his more Victorian sentimental. And I focused just on the actual event of him walking into the hospital ward, going through those doors, and encountering these rows upon rows of beds of young men, many of whom were dying, and many of whom did die in Whitman's arms. And what I found as a greatest challenge was to find a way to set this graphic portrayal of tending a wounded person. I mean, he does discuss the bandages and the bloody sponges and the pails.
The bloody stumps he discusses.
He does. He discusses from the amputated arm. I remove the clotted lint, the gnawing and putrid gangrene. These are words that a composer doesn't generally choose to set to musical tones. And I certainly didn't choose them for their shock value. It seems to me that a nurse every day has to deal with these artifacts of biological decay. And we too often shy away from the realities of the body and focus just on the spirit. And what's wonderful about this poem is that the grimness, the hideous reality of the hospital is coupled perfectly with the spiritual transcendence of the act. And I know of no other poem, I know of no other poet who was able to courageously grapple with these two elements.
Well, let's hear the opening of your composition. My guest is John Adams, and this is The Wound Dresser with baritone Sanford Sylvan.
Bury the bandages, water and sponge, straight and swift to my wounded I go. They lie on the ground after the battle brought me. Where their priceless blood reddens the ground. Or to the rose of the hospital tent, or under the roofed hospital, to the long rows of carts, up and down each side I return. To each and all, one after another, I draw near. Not one do I miss. An attendant follows, holding a tray. He carries a refuse pail, soon to be filled with clotted rags and blood. Empty and filled again,
John Adams sending for the poem The Wound Dresser, written by Walt Whitman. The baritone was Sanford Sylvan, and my guest is the composer, John Adams. When you were writing the setting for the poem, did you like read it over and over to yourself to get to get the line readings that you wanted and the fall of the language?
Yes, I find that the greatest challenge in setting poetry is to capture the way in which the language is spoken. And of course, American is spoken very differently than English. During the composition of my opera, Nixon in China, I found myself taking walks with my librettist Alice Goodman's texts and just not memorizing the text, but just saying them over and over again until I got the right lilt, the right rhythmic feel for the words. And I, of course, did this with the Whitman as well.
I want to do something that shows how really different the two musics on your new record are, and that is like go right to the second composition on your record, which is called Fearful Symmetries, and the mood is absolutely manic on this one. It's good to, you know, when you're listening to it on a CD or a record and they come back to back, it's really quite a sudden shift. Do you think of these two pieces as representing two different but equal sides of your personality as a composer?
Yes. What I've often said, somewhat in jest, is that I've learned to live with the schizophrenic side of my musical personality. And I think probably the greatest moment of liberation for me as a composer was allowing this, particularly this trickster or a wacky side of myself to come out.
Okay, this is John Adams' Fearful Symmetries. The opening of Fearful Symmetries, a recent composition by my guest John Adams, who conducted the orchestra of St. Luke's. One of your earlier pieces that was written in, I think, a similar vein was Grand Pianola Music.
Mm-hmm.
And I've read that at its 1983 premiere, people booed it.
And well, it wasn't the premiere, but it was the second performance. It was at Avery Fisher Hall in New York. The New York Philharmonic played it as part of a festival of contemporary music, much of which was the contemporary music that we often think of. In the midst of all this 12-tone, very dour, grim, serialist music came this piece that had rather vulgar tunes and very glitzy orchestration and strange goings-on in the pianos that sounded a little bit like Rachmaninoff and a little bit like Ferranti and Tyker. And I think it offended a lot of people who felt that such a kind of aggrieved vulgarity shouldn't appear on the programs of the New York Philharmonic.
Well, I was really very impressed when I heard that you were booed, because I think it's very very hard to get that kind of response nowadays, for people to feel so strongly one way or another about something in a concert hall.
Well, not only that, but I think also that the issue of minimalism, which is a style of a musical composition which I work in, was at that time and still continues to be one of great controversy. People feel that it's a kind of retroactive reduction, a simplification of all the great evolutionary developments of 20th century music. And I don't agree. I think that what the minimalist composers have done is really the only significant stylistic growth to have occurred in new music since World War II.
Now, I know that when you graduated college, your parents gave you a copy of John Cage's book, Silence. And when I heard that, I thought, what very hip parents you must have had.
Well, my mother worked in an art gallery in New Hampshire, and Cage's books were stocked in the gallery. I'm not exactly sure she realized the revolutionary impact of her choice. But nevertheless, it was an important book because it forced me to question a lot of the standard Eurocentric values that had been inculcated in me during my years at Harvard in the study of music. Cage forced me to come out of my cocoon and look at the world around me, also to look at sound from a different point of view. Maybe that's an oxymoron, to listen to sound from a different point of view. And generally, I would have to credit him with the decision on my part to leave the university, come out to San Francisco, which I did in 1971, and basically try to make a living as a composer and stay away from academia and college teaching, which is how most serious composers in this country are able to survive.
Now, I know that you were the first undergraduate at Harvard, was it, to write music as your thesis? Was it hard to convince your professors to accept that? And do you have any regrets about it, or do you really think looking back you did the right thing?
Well, first of all, you have to realize that I graduated in 1969, which is the year that most college faculty in the country were being held hostage, either literally or figuratively, by their students. So that year, it was possible to get just about anything done or accomplished. But I think also what the point I was trying to make was that as a composer, my work was creative, and it wasn't research, and it wasn't something that I did by spending countless hours in a library writing a thesis. I made my point, and eventually the programs for composers were developed throughout the country. I'm not saying that I was the leader of this. I'm sure other universities did this first. It's a double-edged sword because, on the one hand, it does allow serious creative activity to take place within the academic environment. But I also think that the academic environment is a very dangerous, possibly even a pernicious one for real creative activity because it is essentially a critical environment. It's one where people basically analyze, and creativity has to have both analysis but also completely intuitive, almost unconscious activity as well. And frequently the university is not the most supportive environment for that.
My guest is composer John Adams. Let's talk a little bit about your recent opera, Nixon in China. And this was the opera was directed by Peter Sellers, who I think originated the idea as well, and approached you to write music for it. And you've said in the past that when he approached you, you thought of when you thought of like an opera with Richard Nixon in it, you thought of Rich Little and Dan Aykroyd, and you couldn't imagine Nixon singing. And I'd like to know how you got around that feeling of absurdity.
Well, I got around that feeling of absurdity immediately by seeing the libretto by the one person that you haven't mentioned, which is Alice Goodman, who's as much a partner in this as Peter or I. Alice's libretto was, I think, an absolutely brilliant work of art in that she was able to capture the language of these Americans, particularly these American Republican politicians, in a way that was both very trenchant, very meaningful, but also very funny, very whimsical. And she played that off against a more stilted type of language that the Chinese would speak, which of course is in English, but has that strange arch feeling that translated Chinese has. And also, her treatment of Nixon was at once very funny and very human, and also, I think, rather dignified. I mean, no matter how much we thrash the man and make fun of him, there were things about him that were still, nevertheless, visionary.
Let me play a short excerpt of your opera, Nixon in China, with James Madalena as Nixon, and this is a, shall we call it an aria, or this is the passage where he sings, "News has a kind of mystery."
Yes, I call it an aria. This is when he steps down off Air Force One and shakes Joe and Lai's hand for the first time and looks up and sees all the television cameras whirring away.
As a kind of mystery. I shook hands, when I shook hands with Joe and Lye, when I shook hands with Joe and Lye, on this bare field outside Peking, just now the whole world was listening. I, the whole world was listening, listening, listening.
An excerpt from, I guess, John Adams' opera Nixon in China. Would you ever do an opera again? I imagine you ran into all kinds of, like, staging things and so on that you were really unused to.
Would I ever do an opera again?
Mm-hmm.
What do you think I'm doing
now?
Yes,
dear.
We're deep into the next opera, Alice and Peter and I. It's called The Death of Klinghoffer. And again, it focuses on a recent contemporary event where the whole world was watching, just as Nixon said in this aria that you just heard here. And we deal, of course, in this case, with the Middle East and the sort of age-old clash of peoples over a small plot of land, and also with another theme, which is similar to Nixon in China, that is of tourists abroad. In a certain way, the Nixon party going to Peking is like a tourist trip. They were tourists going in there and not really knowing what to expect. And it's a similar case with these Americans who were caught on the Achille Lauro when it was hijacked in 1985.
Well, I wish you good luck with your new opera, and I thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
John Adams' new recording of The Wound Dresser and Fearful Symmetries is on Nonesuch. His new opera, The Death of Klinghoffer, is scheduled to premiere in Brussels on March 19th, 1991. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.